You're listening to OU Podcasts.
Everybody, welcome to Operation Ultra Podcast, episode 14. I'm Dustin.
And this is Rachel.
And we've got a couple of good interviews today on the podcast. First, we're going to talk to Eric Grossman, and Eric is an ultra runner extraordinaire. He's got a long history of really good success in ultra running and wins all over the East Coast. And he might not be known to a lot of West Coast guys because he's mostly an East Coast runner, but he is definitely elite. And we get to talk to him about his experience in running, how he got started, and also his attempt at the fastest known time on the Colorado Trail. Also, we get to talk to Susan Howell. Susan Howell is starting a new 100-miler, the first one in the great state of Kentucky. And if you get a chance to check out their website, be sure to look at that background photo. Just from what we've seen of the race, it looks like it'll be very scenic and very difficult at the same time. So we talked to Susan about the new race, what it takes to put on 100, and her experiences there. But first, Rachel, we got to do something fun this past weekend that's a little different than trail running. We got to go out and backpack with our kids as a family. So let me ask you, how different is that experience from trail running to hauling everything on your back when you're backpacking?
Well, I think the major difference is it's about 50 pounds heavier. I mean, when you load everything up into a pack on your back, it slows you down a little bit going up the hills, and it really makes you appreciate being 50 pounds lighter. And we were on the Athens Big Fork Trail, which is a trail that has a local race on it. And it really made me appreciate being lighter in on my trail races. I've never been on that trail before. I've heard of the difficulty of it, and I don't know if it was the added weight of the pack that made it difficult, or if in fact it really is a difficult trail. But I'm leaning towards it is really difficult, and I think I would appreciate it a lot more, a little bit lighter.
It's definitely a rugged and a difficult trail, and I think to me the difficulty is not any one climb, but it's just climb after climb after climb. It's never flat. It's up or down the whole time.
And just to kind of give you an idea of the little bit of the trail that we saw, we went up and over three ridges, and the course for the Athens Big Fork Trail Marathon goes up and over eight ridges and then comes back over those eight ridges. So we were talking about that as we went along three and a half miles that we hiked out to our camping spot, was that we were only covering just a little portion of what they cover in that race.
And to me, I really enjoy the backpacking side of it, because when I'm trail running, when I'm running in general, I kind of have tunnel vision. I don't enjoy the scenery around me. I don't look around. I won't remember things about the courses I run. But backpacking kind of takes you out of the time focus, out of the speed focus, and lets you enjoy nature. It lets you enjoy being outside, being in the woods, being in the middle of nowhere. And honestly, that's what a lot of us like about trail running. Besides the community aspect, we like being outside, and backpacking really gives you that opportunity to do that. If you have never backpacked before, it's super easy. All you really need is a backpack, a tent, and a sleeping bag, and just some minor food you can eat, and you can get out there and do it. It's a hobby that's a lot like others that can be a money pit. It can be very expensive gear you purchase. It can be, you know, spending hundreds of more for a sleeping bag that's a few ounces lighter than your sleeping bag. But I think if you really get outside of that, not worry about that as much, you can get the basic gear for fairly inexpensive.
And the truth is why Dustin really likes backpacking is because it is his inner gear junkie. That's why he likes trail running with the shoes and the packs, but the backpacking also, he gets to do all the geeking out on reviews on gear and stocking up on gear for the whole family.
I won't lie, I enjoy that a little bit. And also, I like the routine of it. You know, you hike, you get to your campsite, you set about your routine of putting up your tent, starting a fire, cooking your food, getting your water, etc. The little chores around the campsite. I enjoy that. I enjoy the whole experience of it. And then when you're done, getting to sit back by the fire and listen to the sound of the wind in the trees, the birds chirping. Usually you don't hear other people, cars, or any of the other sounds of humanity. That's what I like, is getting away from it all. If you've never backpacked but want to, I really highly recommend going to either Amazon Sierra Trading Post, Steep and Cheap, or a handful of other sites where you can find gear fairly inexpensively, and then look up a trail near you, especially if it's something like a wilderness area or National Forest Service land where you can camp just about anywhere.
And I do have to say, all of our camping gear does double duty. When we go to ultras, we take our backpacking gear, and a lot of times we'll set up at the site for the trail runs and camp out before. So, you know, save on your lodging and have the whole ultra experience of camping in a tent before, doing your race, and then camping after. You get to meet other runners that way, and you'll never know the conversations you'll have over a campfire.
Yeah, and let's say you spend $500 on your gear, which you could easily get by under $500. It doesn't take many saved hotel nights to make up for that. So it can be a good investment if you buy good gear. So get the decent stuff, find something on sale like last year's models, and I think you guys will enjoy it as much as we have. So we'll use that as our lead in to our interview with Eric. Eric set out to do a fastest known time on the Colorado Trail this year, and he did not have much success with it. He took a wrong turn, which is understandable. A lot of those trails have spur trails and game trails that intersect there, and he lost his way and ended up off course, so he didn't get to finish the time.
But that hasn't thwarted his attempt. He does plan on heading back out there this summer to give it another attempt. And I believe when he stopped last time, he was at least halfway through. So, you know, that's got to be tough to have your mindset on this goal to get about halfway through it and to have a hiccup like that you really can't recover from. So, but again, he's learned some lessons there, and he talks about that in his interview with us.
And maybe it would be a confidence build. It wasn't his body not handling it. It was a small mistake. It was a small lapse. So, you know, we talked to him about his attempt for it next time, what he might change, and a great time talking about his ultra running experience and literally writing the book on ultra running. So let's kick things off with Eric.
Eric, it's great to have you on the show. Will you tell us a little bit about how you got started running?
Yeah, I got a letter from the cross-country coach at Atherton High School in Louisville, Kentucky, where I grew up. You know, I was a incoming freshman. I got this letter that said I'd be good, you know, candidate for the cross-country team, but I considered coming out. So I felt special, so I went out for cross-country, and I didn't realize, of course, that all of the incoming freshmen had gotten that same letter. But in the meantime, you know, I did actually discover that it probably was a good thing for me to do. So after that first season, I opted in to stick with the running throughout high school and in college.
Did you have a particular focus and distance? Were you a middle distance guy?
I mean, mostly slow twitch fibers. Pretty much the longer I went, the better I did. So that trend has continued. You know, of course, in high school, you can run the mile and the 2 mile, and then in college, the 5,000 and 10,000. And then after I graduated, you know, I did do some half marathons and then a few marathons. And of course, years later, embarked on the ultra career.
And how did you get into the ultra world? What was your first race that you picked out?
Well, I was teaching high school, and it wasn't actually a race, but I did decide I needed to do something kind of big. Epic wasn't really the term at the time, but, you know, I just knew I needed to do something to kind of get out of the rut of teaching that I had gotten in. So I applied and got into graduate school, and at the same time, I decided to do the Appalachian Trail as a through hike. I hadn't done much hiking. I'd done a lot of running, so I kind of calculated what I thought would be reasonable mileages, having not, again, been on the Appalachian Trail, and thought I could do it in the summer before I started my doctoral work. But of course, realized pretty quickly when I was actually on the trail that, you know, you can't keep up, say, 8 mile per hour pace on the terrain that's the Appalachian Trail. So I ended up doing half of it in 97 and the other half in 98. And while I was on the trail, I heard about for the first time, you know, this thing, which was an ultra marathon. I heard about David Horton's race, the Mount Maskist. Of course, David Horton is, you know, the grandfather of ultras in the East and South, and was known among hikers as well, because it hadn't been that long since he had set the, you know, supported record trek of the Appalachian Trail himself. So I heard about that, and I thought that would be a good combination, having kind of gotten my trail legs after the hike and having my running background, I thought running 50 made a lot of sense. So that became my first ultra in the fall of 1998. And once again, I was disillusioned with the reality. It was a very difficult run. I did end up finishing and came in eighth, or tied for eighth at least. And then I didn't run another step for 2 years after that.
So it wasn't the kind of experience that just hooked you from the beginning?
Well, I mean, I don't know that you would call it hooked from the beginning, but I guess that idea that it had conquered me, you know, trying to run the Mountain Massacres in 98, must have kind of festered in my mind. You know, in the meantime, I got married and had my son, Gavin. I guess it just sort of incubated in the back of my mind for those 2 years that I didn't run. And finally, I decided I needed to sort of redeem myself and run the Mountain Massacres again, but this time hoping to, you know, instead of being bettered by the course, hopefully better the course. And yeah, it worked out better the second time. I guess at that point, maybe you would call me hooked. From that year on, I probably did more like 6 to 8 ultras each year.
Your ultra running results page is rather long. I mean, it's you haven't been doing this necessarily all that long, but you know, for 11 years or so, but you've run a lot of races in that span of time. Do you have one race in particular that kind of stands out among the others?
Well, just for nostalgic reasons, as I was describing, the Mountain Massacres stands out. You know, it's been a long-standing race, even before I ran it back in 98. So just sort of historically, it has a specialness, a significance. And for me personally, too, it intersects the Appalachian Trail, and it finishes at Montebello, Virginia, a place that I, you know, have one of these epiphanies while I was on that Appalachian Trail. So for that reason, I would mention that race. But another David Horton race is actually one that I enjoy more, and I think represents the best the sport has, and that's the Promise Line 50K. I think it just it really features, you know, the beauty that's possible when you're out in the mountains, and of course, layout is I think ideal. It's challenging. You know, it's actually longer than the 50K. It has single track. It has a lot of open running, a lot of climbing, fast finish. So to me, it sets up perfectly, and I would say that's my favorite race.
And you mentioned Mountain Massacres being special for you. You know, that was the kind of the start of your ultra running career, and you finished top 10 there your first year. And when you went back, you had a lot of success, including winning it. Does that feel like a little bit of redemption? You know, that's where you started your ultra running career, and you felt like you were bested by the distance, and then to go back and to win it, that had to kind of be a little bit cathartic.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And that's kind of, yeah, you've pinpointed the specialness of it. Yeah, it represented, I think, what drives a lot of us. And that's, you know, you get something that's sort of under your skin and won't let go. And then you set an ambitious goal and work toward it over a long period of time. And it does take a lot of work to, you know, to manage across a difficult and long course like that. So you train for it and prepare. And then when it actually works the way you were planning and hoping it would, yeah, absolutely. It was very special.
And you mentioned David Horton's race at Promised Land, but it looks like another race that you go back for often is Hellgate. So why is Hellgate not considered one of your favorite races?
Well, no, I wouldn't say that. You know, you can only have one favorite. No, Hellgate is a great race. And I've been there, you know, 4 times, I think. And it also kicked my butt the first time that I did it and, you know, got under my skin and sort of just irritated me that I hadn't done well. And again, I'm not even talking about that sort of relative to other runners, but just feeling like, you know, I didn't perform as well as I could. And so, yeah, I came back and felt like I did better. Then what happened was another runner came and got the course record to, you know, replace the one I had set when I came back. And so I wanted to go back, and I was ready to retire last year had I managed to go under the course record, and I could have called it quits and felt good about it. But once again, my plans were thwarted, and the weather didn't quite cooperate, but, you know, there are probably other things conspiring too. And I didn't get it, so here I am still running. We'll see how long it lasts.
Are you contemplating hanging up your shoes, so to speak, and kind of leaving some ultras behind?
Yes, but I should qualify that by saying at least twice before I've said the same thing and then started running again, so I can't be held to it.
Since your time may be waning in ultra running, do you have any races on your bucket list or any unfinished business that you feel like you need to go back and rectify?
Well, as I said, had I been able to set the record at Hellgate, then I would have felt satisfied, I think. So that's still there. I also didn't quite complete what I set out to do in Colorado last summer. I hoped to get the FKT at the Colorado Trail, or at least, you know, make a good bid for it, and didn't make that. I'd set that as a goal again this summer, and I'm having some questions about whether I'm really ready to do the FKT attempt. I did fall in love with Colorado while I was there, though, and I'm certainly going to be back out there and back on the Colorado Trail one way or the other this summer. So those two things, a faster Hellgate and a Colorado Trail crossing are on my mind.
Well, and specifically, I go back to Western States, and I know you kind of talk about in one of your posts at Runner's World, which we'll link to in the show notes, kind of having some difficult times there. Is that something that you feel you might want to go back and give a shot at again, or are you kind of more of an East Coast guy?
Well, the short answer is no, I don't feel compelled to go back. I don't know that it has as much to do with being an East Coast guy. I think I just decided that the conquest of the hot summer, high elevation, arid 100 isn't something that I need to complete. You know, I put time into it, as you know, three tries, you know, and I tried to prepare. I never could put all the pieces together. And at least part of that is that it just is not natural for me to put myself through that much, at least dry heat. I know the dry heat's not supposed to be as bad, but for me, at least, it's at least as bad, you know, for that much time. So I just pretty much said, hey, I gave it three shots. I can move on to other things.
Do you prefer the more rugged or the more technical terrain of the East Coast, or do you like the groomed West Coast stuff?
Well, I'm glad you put it that way, that the trails out here in the East are actually more demanding in terms of footing. I don't know that I prefer that. I like the lushness of the East Mountains. You know, I love running through rhododendron and just, you know, the green tunnels, we put it from a hiker's perspective. You feel and you are more exposed out west. And that may be part of it, the exposure, the, you know, drier conditions. Yeah, I can't quite put my finger on it, but I definitely feel more at home here.
I like to run. You know, when I do races, I want to be able to run. And some of the eastern, the trails around where we are in the middle of Arkansas, just they're very rocky and not necessarily difficult from a climbing perspective, just footing. It's really difficult to run when every step is contemplated with, am I going to end up on my face on this downhill or am I going to fall backwards on this uphill? But, you know, that definitely does, I guess, give you a more varied experience on the East Coast than West Coast. I did Tahoe, and they were just great, gorgeous. It looked like crushed granite trails the entire way,
yeah.
But there was very little tree cover, and you are in just directly in the sun for just about the entire time. And while you do have great views, you kind of do miss being a little protected from the sun and the wind at times.
Yeah, and I think you also said something important there in terms of the variety afforded, you know, in Eastern Mountains. There are places where you can get non-technical single track, you know, stretches, and there are places obviously you can top out and be above tree line for short periods of time, or, you know, at least in areas that don't have a lot of vegetation, and can be more technical on exposed areas, and that variety is attractive to me. And I, like you, I like to run. not so much just scramble all the time. But I think we have choices enough to find events or courses or routes that you know, let you do plenty of running. Hellgate is mostly running, and other Virginia events, you know, have ample opportunity for running.
Well, and it seems like a direct opposite of that is a race that kind of stands out on your list is Cruel Jewel. You finished second there, but for 100 mile and 30 hours, that seems like a significant event. Can you tell us a little bit about that event and what makes it so difficult?
Yeah, you had to bring that one up. I should qualify that by saying that I was preparing for a Colorado Trail trek when I registered for that. I knew I wasn't going to run it as a competitive race, so let me qualify by saying that. But I also have to point out that Willie Sindrum, who designed the course over a period of years living there, you know, purposefully, willfully set out to, as diabolically as possible, put together, you know, a set of climbs that, you know, maximize the difficulty. So, you know, it's a long-term planned route to maximize difficulty. So he just found every climb. And I don't think people realize the climbing available there in Georgia. And they were just, it was just crazy amount of steep climbs, some of them long as well. It was very difficult. Yeah, and the weather was difficult. It was variable, you know, hot first afternoon and then cold and rainy and windy at night when we were running. And I think it started like 2 in the afternoon or something. So, a lot of factors conspiring to make it the most difficult race that I've participated in.
But another one you have on the calendar that hopefully won't be quite that difficult is the Thunder Rock 100. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how you're coming along in your preparations for it?
Yeah, and this is an inaugural event, and I was fortunate to have already been on Rock Creek's running team, and they're a sponsor of the event put on by Wild Trails there in Chattanooga. And I had been invited as part of that team to come down and scout out the courses. They were still making plans last spring. So I went down for a 3-day weekend, you know, and did a third of the course each day, a third of the proposed course, try to recreate some of the conditions runners would face on the race day. And they were quite open to feedback, and, you know, we were thinking about the best way to lay out the course and any adjustments, and they took some of my, you know, feedback to heart and made some adjustments, and those are reflected in the current plan for the route. And then, of course, that's happening next month, May. I've sort of been split in terms of my preparations because I've also been preparing to trek the Colorado Trail. So part of the time I've been, you know, putting on my backpack and carrying a water filter and, you know, food for 2 days and going out, you know, for an overnight trek with my poles and all that. And then another part of the time I'll go out and run a, you know, 25-mile run in the morning or whatever. And that's been going pretty well. And I'm supposed to go down Friday and check out the first 50 miles of the course for Thunder Rock. So I'd say it's going pretty well. I'm not sort of the mindset to full-on compete, you know, as I might have a few years ago, because I do still have in the back of my mind sort of the trekking mentality, a more sustainable. But I'm looking forward to being on the course, and it features a lot of beautiful single track that I really discovered for the first time when I went down to scout the route, you know, last year.
You've scouted part of it. What's the runability of it like?
Well, it's kind of like we were describing. There are plenty of sections of open running. There's some double track as well, but even some of the single track, I would describe as runnable, you know, more runnable than, say, the Appalachian Trail. Now, there are stretches, you know, that are rocky and would make you go slower, but, you know, not certainly as rocky as some races in the East.
So you mentioned you're still kind of in the trekking mentality. Are you're planning on getting back out on the Colorado Trail again?
Yeah, so I'm planning to head out in June and acclimatize for a couple of weeks, and then in July at least trek the trail. I'm not going to promise to go for the FKT again, but at least make good time.
What's the distance of the trail, and what kind of time would you have to post to get the FKT?
The trail's about 480 miles, and last summer, Scott Jaime from Denver set the fastest known time in something very close to 8 days and 8 hours, total cumulative time. So you'd have to do a little better than that.
That's a good 50 to 50 miles and change a day. How do you prepare for that? How is the training for that kind of attempt different from your ultra running training?
Yeah, and that's a good question. And that's sort of how I've been trying to split, my time. To me, you have to be doing a lot of slower trekking where you were focused more on, spending all day for at least a couple of days in a row, sort of training your body to maybe burn more fat or store more energy and reserves, maybe strengthen some of the connective tissue that is most likely to fail when you put that much strain on it over the course of several days. So those factors weigh more heavily if you're preparing for a long distance FKT like that, as opposed to, if you're trying to set a course record in a 50K or something, you are working on aerobic capacity and probably mitochondrial density or something like that, doing speed work and tempo runs and that kind of thing.
When you're doing that kind of attempt, you're carrying a lot of your supplies. Are you carrying a shelter, or are you planning on moving most of the time while you're out there?
Well, that's a good question too. And as I said, I made the attempt last year, and the idea, the planning involved meeting a crew at road crossings and being able to spend the night so that I wouldn't have to carry overnight gear or shelter. What happened that contributed at least to the downfall of the effort was that, after 40 miles one day, we're up above 12,000 feet and rain sets in and cold, and we had a very hard final close to 20 miles that day that went into the night, into the dark. We sort of had to keep going, because had we stopped, without shelter, we would have suffered from hypothermia and maybe not made it back at all. So instead, we extended ourselves too far and then put ourselves in a hole that we couldn't get out of. And it's a much longer story than that, of course. But the bottom line is the adaptation I wanted to make for this year was to at least be able to have the flexibility to have shelter, to set something up quickly if needed on the fly, and adjust according to the weather and other needs that arise that you can't fully predict. So I adapted a pack to carry a tent and sleeping bag that I could get from a crew person, and have actually less crew this time around, but more flexibility, more options to camp along the way if needed.
So do you see yourself kind of breaking away if you do retire from ultras and getting into more of the fast packing like that?
Yeah, I think that could be, the next thing that keeps me going. All of us have to answer the question of why we do this all the time. If we don't have a positive answer, we would stop. So, I've had answers, apparently, for a dozen years or so. And, I want to keep coming up with answers. But, I'm not sure that it's going to be sort of the same old thing. I'm thinking probably this more adventure-style events, will keep me in it.
I think we as ultra runners will always want to have some sort of goal we can train for, or something that we're trying to attain. I think that's maybe one of the things that draws us into the sport, is we can have these big events and then work hard to achieve those, and then look what's around the corner and find that next big event. I mean, obviously, to compete as well as you do, you've had a competitive drive. Do you think you'll still have that competitive drive behind you?
Well, that's a good question, and I think you kind of answered it the way I would, which is that it's perhaps less about the competitiveness and more about the desire to put something out there that's ambitious, and then to figure out a way to prepare for it and to sort of base your training around something that you've put as a goal, and then, you know, see how it works. And you get that feedback while you're training, and then you get the sort of ultimate feedback of did it work at the event you had targeted. And I guess it's a little teleological. You can make whatever goal you want, but sort of the nice thing about at least the short history of ultramarathoning is, you know, it's a bit fringe because it is difficult. You know, it sets an ambitious bar, and I guess as more and more people have taken to it, and it's become a little less peripheral, a little less fringe. You know, at least some of us are looking for other ways to sort of branch out and try other kinds of ambitious activities and events that we can use to, I don't know, to give us an excuse to go play out in the woods and in the mountains.
I think you nailed it on the head. I think, you know, I like to call it, I guess, fast packing, but doing those more long distance trail runs, I think that's going to be the next wave of what ultra runners will transition to do the next big crazy thing. But as more and more folks come into ultra running, one of the things that my wife and I experienced when we were new into this was, well, there wasn't a great source of information. The only people we could talk to about it were fellow ultra runners. People's opinions on Dean Karnazes aside, he literally had just about the only book on ultra running around until Born to Run came out. But you know, back a handful of years ago, you and Brian Powell set out and actually wrote the book on ultra running. What was that experience like? And if you had to go back, is there anything you'd change in that book?
I guess you're talking about Brian Powell's book, Relentless Forward Progress, that I helped with. No, I think I handled that about right. You know, I was approached by someone who had already gotten the contract to write it. And I said that, you know, it's really not sort of my specialty would be to create a, you know, a pretty basic guide for a general audience. But I said, I know just the guy, and I asked Brian myself if he would be interested in that, and he was. And, you know, I told him what I would be able to contribute, and he was open to that, and we had just negotiated how to figure that out. And I thought it worked out really well, actually. I was pleased with the book, and I think it does what it purports to do. You know, it lays out some things that I think are very helpful for a general audience who is interested either in sort of bumping up their level and running ultras or in getting into ultras to begin with. So I actually thought it worked out pretty well.
Rachel and I both, we read it. We really enjoyed it because it really does go into good detail about all the different nuances of ultra running and kind of giving an introductory overview of how to get from not running ultras to, you know, being able to do a longer distance race, but also all the other details in between. We put on a 100K here locally, and we had a couple of young runners contact us. They wanted to run the race, but they literally had no clue what drop bags were or anything about how ultras were run. And we actually sent them an email and said, hey, you should check out this book because it kind of goes into details and will give you all the info you need.
And that was the idea. I mean, that was pretty clear that was the objective. And I thought Brian did a good job of pulling that together. And he knows so many people, you know, at various levels in the ultra community, that I think he was really the ideal person to do it.
And we had seen elsewhere online that someone had mentioned talking to you about and put a training plan together. Is that something you tend to do for other ultra runners?
I have done that, and I kind of, you know, considered the possibility of doing a little more coaching. It really has never sort of picked up momentum, and that's okay. You know, I have enough other things to keep me occupied. But yeah, I'm interested in sort of the human performance side, sort of trying to figure out what works and what doesn't, and tinkering with it, and seeing people progress, you know, given their goals, progress toward those. You know, that's an interest. Right now, I'm helping with our, you know, our little local high school track team, sort of similar idea, you know, just doing a little assistant coaching.
I don't think you could do much better than having someone with your ultra running experience putting together those training programs. So if anybody out there hasn't contacted you yet, I'm sure you'd have a lot of good insight to contribute.
Yeah, and I have done it just on an informal basis, just at least offer feedback or, you know, nutrition ideas or whatever. Sure.
We really appreciate your time, and we look forward to seeing, you know, how you do at Thunder Rock, but also, and probably me more so, how you do on your upcoming Colorado Trail journeys, and as you kind of refine your process there and go after that fastest known time.
Well, I sure appreciate it.
It's hard for me to fathom being at that level of ultra running where I can be disappointed with a second place finish or third place finish or running some of the times he does and not considering myself truly competitive at that point.
It seems like what keeps bringing him back is knowing that he can do a little better or best his time or someone else's time and hold on to that record. And really, that's what brings us all back to ultras is success and doing good and feeling good about what we're doing. I don't think many of us reach the level that he has.
No, he's put in a lot of work and he's had a lot of success, obviously. So our next interview, we talk to Susan Howell, who is starting the Cloud Splitter 100 this year, Kentucky's first 100 miler. And Rachel and I have had the experience of starting races before. Rachel, what do you think was the hardest part of starting either the Soaring Wings Half Marathon that we started, the road race, or the Love at 100K?
Well, you know, Soaring Wings was our first dive into race directing period. And, you know, even though there's a lot of resources online, it's hard to find one that's specifically tailored to the task that you're working on. I think it's really just not knowing. And, you know, just like any task that you go into, not knowing whether you'll succeed or it'll flop majorly. And knowing that when you have people that have handed over your money and are expecting a good race experience, you know, having the burden of, I have to pull this off and it has to go smoothly because a lot of people are depending on me on race day.
To me, it was an interesting experience. It was like business planning, but your business only lives for 4 hours one day out of the year. For us, our course was open for 4 hours. So there were so many moving pieces, so much planning, so many things had to go right, all leading up to, you know, 4 hours on race day from when the starting gun went off at 8 a.m. to when the course closed at noon. And there's very little tolerance for mistakes on race day. You could go from a perfectly planned event and then have one mistake, like we heard about a race in the UK where the water guys didn't show up. No matter how greatly they may have planned their event, it's looked at as a total failure just because one of those pieces of the puzzle fell apart. So to me, that was a difficult experience. Quite often folks ask us questions about, oh, how can I get this 5K fundraiser started? Or I'd like to start a race. How do I do it? And while we don't try to be discouraging to folks who ask us that or ask us for some information or for some help, we really try to give them a little bit of a dose of reality because it's really hard work. There's so many races out there now that it's really hard to get a lot of turnout to make it profitable. So what we tell people to focus on is first, find a niche. You've got to find what makes your race different than other races, and you've got to make sure that even if there is some competition, there's a reason for folks to go to your event as opposed to someone else's. If you're doing just another 5K and there's five other 5Ks that Saturday, you probably would be lucky to get 100 folks out at your race, and it's really hard to turn a profit when you're charging $20 to $25 for a 5K with only 100 people or so. So then you have to look at other avenues like sponsorship. And we really believe that if you can have one sponsor and look at sponsorship to underwrite your fixed costs, the things that you know you're going to have to pay for up front and get those out of the way, then you're ahead of the game. You can really be profitable as if you can get a sponsor to underwrite those fixed costs. And then you've got to put together an event that you as a runner would want to run. So you want to make sure you have a good shirt design. A lot of folks now, you know, view the shirt as a throwaway. I really think good shirt designs draw people in. If you have something that's interesting, something that folks would wear after the fact, not only does it draw them to your race again and give them a good experience, but it draws other people to your race when they wear it out in public.
A good shirt design is advertising for you year round for your event. You know, people wear it, it stands out, it gets noticed, and then other people ask them about the event. If they had a good time, they share what a good race it was, and they basically do the promotion for you.
One of the things that brought a lot of success for us was just buying and providing as much food as our budget allowed. So at our race, we wanted to make sure we had a nice community atmosphere afterwards. We didn't want to be one of these races that shuttled people through the finish line, kicked them out, and said, have a nice day. We want folks to hang around and talk with each other and build that community aspect. So not only did we provide lots of food for the runners, in the later years, it was over 300 pizzas. We also provided a bunch of food to all the spectators that showed up. I think it was along the lines of 2,000 hamburgers and 2,000 hot dogs in the last year. So that really drew people in when they knew their friends and family that could come watch the race would also get fed and get to stay around and watch things, and they'd have a good spectating spot without being kicked away. I think that was important for folks. So those were our basic measures of success. Find a niche and make it something people want to run. Those were our two keys for success. I'll give them a bonus point. The bonus point is limit your big mistakes. Every year we would make a small mistake. It could be, you know, something didn't get delivered on time, volunteers didn't show up at a certain area, etc. There's any number of things that can go wrong. One of those balls can drop. But if you limit your big mistakes, if you make sure all the big things happen, most participants and spectators aren't going to see the small thing that might not happen exactly the way you want it to. So make sure you overly plan and handle all the big things. And if a small mistake happens, don't fret about it. Most folks aren't going to see it. So if you want to start a race and you think you've got a great idea, we encourage you, go after it. At least that's what brought us success in the races that we've started before. Without further ado, let's kick off the interview with Susan and learn about this new 100 miler in Kentucky.
Susan, you have started Cloud Splitter 100, which will be Kentucky's first 100 mile. Is that correct?
That's right.
Tell us the dates on that and a little bit about the race.
Okay, this year it will be October 4th and 5th. Last year, when I started looking around for a place in Kentucky to host a 100 mile trail event, I really can't even remember how I found Pine Mountain. I've lived here since 1991 and never heard of it. But when I went over there and saw it, I said, something's got to be done over here because it's remarkably beautiful. It's fantastic in that it is a mountain that has not been logged or mined, strip mined or anything like that. So it's a wonderful wilderness, and started talking with people at the Pine Mountain Trail Conference about my idea, and they were very much in favor of it. And things have just snowballed from there.
I guess the bigger question I have is then what got you, what made you think, hey, there needs to be 100 here?
It's just so unique. I mean, this is a 275 million year old mountain. It's a trail that it's actually a Kentucky State Park. This Pine Mountain State Scenic Trail is a Kentucky State Park, and it's a linear state park. So the northernmost point is actually where we're going to start in Elkhorn City and run southwest toward Whitesburg. And it's really only been used by hikers. Having a trail run over there is going to bring a new sport to the area. It's proving to be very challenging to figure out, you know, where to put aid stations. I've enlisted the National Guard to help. We're going to have a couple of aid stations supplied by horse because we can't get to the area by car because there's no road there. But I just really want people to go over there because it's so beautiful.
It sounds very remote. What is the terrain like as far as the footing as you go through the area?
Well, it's an established trail, and it's a well-maintained trail, and there are blazes along the trail. There are 60 miles of trail currently established right now from Elkhorn City toward Whitesburg. And eventually, the trail will go all the way to Cumberland Gap National Historical Park. Now, where you start in Elkhorn City, it's about 900 feet in elevation. You get on the trail, and it's an old pioneer road, and you start climbing up. And it's rocky, but it's wide. And you climb up to pretty close to 3,000 feet within 4.5 or so miles. And then, once you're on top of the mountain, you're on a sawtooth range that winds between Virginia and Kentucky. The first section is called the Birch Knob section. It's about 30 miles in length, and it ends at US 23 and Pound Gap, and there's going to be a big aid station there. And then the 100 milers will actually proceed onto the next section of trail, which is the Highland section, and do a couple of out and backs because we have to avoid a nature preserve. We can't use their their land, and then they'll turn around and head back.
On your website, you've got the courses listed for the shorter distance races, but are you still working out all the logistics for the 100-mile event?
Yeah, we're going to put those up probably tomorrow or the next day. Again, I've had to go back to the nature preserve, and they permit hiking through there all day and all night, but they will not permit people to run. So I kind of had to get that issue squared away, and having done that, we do have the 100-mile course. It's just a matter of drawing the maps and scanning them and putting them up on the website. We've got all of our aid stations, our crew accessibility points, and everything. And it turns out that for crew purposes and aid stations, things are going to be super easy.
So one of the things, we're going to have to go ahead and get this out of the way there. The race lists a 40-hour cutoff.
As you know, most 100-mile trail races have a 30-hour cutoff. Because of the terrain, the remote, rocky nature of this terrain, I've decided to extend it to 40 hours. It's a strenuous course to hike. And in talking to a lot of ultra runner friends of mine, if people can continue moving forward, they can finish in the 40-hour cutoff, no problem. I just didn't want to engage people in something that has approximately 27,000 feet of elevation gain in the 100-mile distance and only give them 30 hours.
Yeah, that would definitely seem a little bit difficult, but, you know, across that distance, is it just the sheer amount of climbing that's the issue, or is it some, you know, some slower footing and more technical areas?
There are some technical areas, but again, the trail is there. There are probably five or so huge rock outcroppings that people have to cross. And then again, once you're up on top of the mountain, it's not like it's flat. You have some, you know, ascents and descents. In the inaugural year, I just didn't want to make it something that there was a problem with people, you know, couldn't finish within the allotted time.
For all our listeners, you should go check out the Cloud Splitter website. We'll have the link in the show notes. There's a great picture of that area. Is that indicative, Susan, of the terrain that the runners would see?
Yes, it is. And when you're on top of the mountain, there are many, many places where you can stop and look, and that's exactly what you're going to be seeing.
Being an inaugural event, what kind of registration do you expect to see the first year?
Well, I'm hoping that overall we'll have 175 plus people. Interestingly, the race is getting a lot of interest already. I've got people emailing me from California, Texas, a lot of ultra runners who kind of really like the gutsy, gnarly, you know, unusual, tough terrain. They're very, very excited about it. I've got several people already signed up for the 100, and people telling me we've got a group coming from Nashville. We've got a four or five guys coming from Northern Illinois. So, and the other thing we're doing is the race weekend in Elkhorn City, the start finishes at the ballpark right in town. And we're going to have 2 days worth of festivities because of the long cutoff for people that are waiting for the longer distances to finish. So we're going to have food and games and traditional Appalachian music and storytelling, you know, a bunch of other things. I've invited the settlement schools from the areas to come so people can experience Central Appalachia in a way that maybe hasn't been featured before.
Again, the race is in early October. And Susan, hey, thanks for your time today. And we wish you the best of luck at the inaugural race this year.
Thank you very much.
It's always interesting when you see a new race pop up on the race calendar. You never really know what it is that makes the race unique. So it's good to get to talk to the race director, you know, hear what their thoughts are, their inspiration for why they came up the race, why they think their race is unique. And, you know, really no one knows the course better than the race director because they have been over it, planning on the maps. They've walked the course multiple times. They probably know every rock and stone on the course.
And with Ultra Runs, the course is really important. It's really one of the big things that draws folks out there is a scenic trail. And from the pictures I saw on their website and online, it looks like it's going to be a gorgeous race course. The toughness will it'll stand out as a pretty difficult race. So we wish them the best of luck this year in the first 100. And if you'd like to sign up or learn more about it, you can check out the show notes on our website.
Well, that's it for this week. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you like what you heard, head over to iTunes and subscribe to our podcast. Also, you can check out our show notes at operationultra.com/episode14 to find links to anything mentioned in the podcast.
And of course, we're always out there on social media. You can reach us on Facebook at facebook.com/operationultra. We're also on Twitter, twitter.com/operationultra, and use that hashtag opultra if you want to single us out in a tweet. Or you can visit our website, operationultra.com, and leave us a comment. Send us an email at info@operationultra.com if you've got an idea for something that we should talk about on the podcast, or a great person that you think we should interview. We'd appreciate any heads up you might give us.
Thanks to everyone who's headed on over to our iTunes page and left a review. We appreciate you guys taking the time for that. That helps us get the word out tremendously.
And we'd ask that you do that. If you haven't done that yet, we'd really appreciate it. And until next time,
happy trails.
And we'll see you next week.